like this, it can only be one guy.
All right, y'all, and we are signing out. Bless each and every one of you that was tuning in. And if you missed the show and half of the show, CKUT.ca. This is Montreal Sessions every Tuesday from 3 to 5. My last show will be next week, and keep it locked because I got a whole lot of surprises. And yeah, we got some more Montreal artists. So for all your artists that are in your feelings because we didn't play you, get over it. Happy Tuesday. Just trying to live that good life in paradise. That's why I sacrifice all this time to make sure your flow ain't half as nice. I deserve bragging rights. This is the classic type. No electric feel, but you can feel the goosebumps and the static, right? I had to have it like, but now I'm a prodigy. And my mob's always deep and that'll follow me. You should honor me. I know that's a little cocky, but later I won't accept no apologies. Nah. Making a classic.
There is this thing. Do you realize?
Consciousness is affected.
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on.
What?
Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called?
The news brought to you live.
Hi, welcome back to Unfit to Print. This is CKUT on 90.3 FM in Montreal. I'm Sean Lathrop.
And I'm Amy Lloyd. Today we broadcast live from the Teotihuacan, the traditional territory of Haudenosaunee and the Anishinaabe Nations. The time now is 5:02.
On this week's episode, we have an interview with Canadian icon and Indigenous activist Buffy St. Marie. Our culture editor, Yasna Kadamian, talked to Buffy on the phone last week. They discussed her identity as an Indigenous artist in the 1960s, environmental justice, and her efforts to decolonize the music industry through her activism and music. We also have Olivia Berkowitz from Amuse coming on to do a segment we are calling Unions 101. Do not worry, this is not your poli-sci Marxist bros segment. Get ready to learn about how labor and class issues intersect with settler colonialism and misogyny against women of color, and how this manifests itself on McGill's campus.
And of course, we'll give you an update on local news. Enjoy the rest of our jingle and a little tune.
Play How Black Mothers Say I Love You, directed by Tamara Brown. This is the story of Daphne, a Jamaican woman who immigrated to Canada in the hopes of providing a better life for her children. Through years of separation, her relationship with her daughters is put to the test, and she learns the true consequences of her unthinkable sacrifice. This play brings a new narrative to mother-daughter relationships. How Black Mothers Say I Love You plays at Center Theatre from February 27th to March 16th. For tickets, call 514-288-3161 or visit centertheatre.com. This This is a Black Theater Workshop production and a CKUT co-presentation.
was Tess Roby with Beacon. The time now is 5:09. Now for our weekly headline roundup. This past Saturday, dozens of women marched the streets of Montreal to protest the ever-present discriminatory nature of the 1867 Indian Act, which was enacted over 150 years ago. Despite revisions, the act continues to act as a barrier for Indigenous women who are trying to pass on their status to familial descents. Sharon McIver, in 1994, challenged the Constitution with sex discrimination clauses in the Indian Act. In November of 2010, she filed a complaint against Canada to the UN. McIver stated that Canada continues to discriminate against Aboriginal women and their descendants in determination of eligibility for registration as an Indian. Just this past January, the UN recognized the Indian Act responsible for sex discrimination.
Every Friday this semester, DeVest McGill is holding demonstrations on the steps of the Art Building. These weekly gatherings have been organized in order to protest McGill's continuing investment in the fossil fuel industry. DeVest aims to raise awareness about current climate issues and the practice of divestment through these fossil-free Fridays. Of the 645 publicly traded companies McGill invests in, 35 are among the world's largest fossil fuel corporations. DeVest McGill's mission is to make students aware of this fact, encourage the university's administration to take action, and ultimately to divest. Our mission is to get McGill to divest its endowment fund from the fossil fuel companies with the goal of making it a statement that they are really divorcing themselves from anything related to industries that are harming the environment. Here, the main effect of divestment is a political and social one, said Violet Drouin, a member of DeVest McGill.
In Ontario, a coalition of student groups are asking the Ontario government to revise upcoming cuts to post-secondary grants. The Canadian Federation of Students, the Elementary Teachers Federation of Ontario, and the Ontario Public Sector Employees Union are a few groups involved in said coalition. This January, the provincial government of Ontario decided to get rid of free tuition for low-income tuition students whilst cutting down tuition fees by 10%. Students and unions argue these cuts will only increase debt and restrict access to education. Groups plan to meet and rally today at Ontario's legislature.
In December 2017, Mile End resident Tim Forrester was notified that he and other building residents were being evicted in order from their apartments in order to be renovated into permanent Airbnbs. The new owners pressured the residents to leave as soon as possible. According to the Régie de Logement, a landlord is allowed to evict previous tenants if they have plans to divide the dwelling, enlarge it substantially, or change its destination. The latter motive implies that converting the apartments to Airbnbs can be legal, but only after obtaining a permit that Forster believes the new owners did not have. According to a 2017 study by McGill geography professor David Waxmuck, in March 2017, only 42 of the over 6,000 full-time rentals available in Montreal on Airbnb were properly certified. The tenants of Forster's building contested the landlord's attempts to push them out prematurely. During the negotiations, the landlord's intentions were made clear. Some of the other neighbors said that they were basically told, "If you win the right to stay, we will make your life hell." Two of the apartments were vacated ahead of schedule. The landlord quickly began renovations, which included unannounced water cuts, walls caked in dust, and endless noise. Forster and his roommates ended up moving out 2 months early. Airbnb puts pressure on a housing market that is already undergoing rapid gentrification. In some Montreal neighborhoods, Airbnb's listings have taken over 2-3% of the housing stock, suggests the WACMA study. Airbnb's presence in these neighborhoods contributes to a rise in rent and increasing evictions. Despite efforts to tighten regulation of these rentals, including a push to restrict short-term tourist residence permits in the Ville-Marie borough last summer, more listings still escape notice.
That was our weekly headline roundup. Please stay tuned for a special report after this song.
Thank you. Social Justice Day is 2019. Looking out, looking in. February 19th to 22nd at various campus and community spaces. Join Kuperk McGill for a series of workshops, discussions, film screenings, and social events highlighting local organizing. Events to include workshops on Indigenous perspectives on harm reduction, contemporary colonialisms, Palestine and Tibet, deep accessibility, building capacity beyond basics, No Borders, No Prisons, a film screening of Migrant Dreams, a trivia night with Stand, discussing realities behind bars. All events are wheelchair accessible, free, and open to the public. More information is available at kupergmcgill.org/socialjusticedays. Social Justice Days 2019, a CKUT co-presentation. Ask me no more questions, tell me no more
lies. You're serving and protect. Welcome back to Unfit to Print. The time now is 5:18. Before that ad, we had Naked Ass Marimba by Lemon Grab. You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Now for our interview with Buffy St. Marie.
My first question is, where do you draw inspiration from when writing your music?
Oh, gosh, you know, I have a life just like everybody else does, and stuff happens. But for me, it's like I've got a little camera in my head, and I'm always just taking little snapshots. And the when life does something impressive in front of me, I'll take a picture. I'll write a song, or I'll get inspired to make a painting. But it's just the everyday stuff that that happens to, you know, to you and everybody who's listening. I don't know. I just turn it into stuff. But it's very, very ordinary things. But sometimes it's things that most people are not seeing, because I have the great advantage of having all these airplane tickets for the past over 50 years that have allowed me to travel to not only the great stages of the world, you know, as a concert artist, but also little small indigenous places in, you know, in Scandinavia, in Australia, in the Americas. So I get to report back on things that most people are not getting to see.
That's really amazing. I just had another question. What do you see as the role of music in social activism? And more specifically, how do you use music as a form of activism?
Oh, golly, you know, it's so natural to me that it's almost hard to look at it in that way. I don't feel as though music is required to do anything, really, because music is about everything, just everything. Think of a 360-degree sphere. Musicians come from every part of that sphere, and we appreciate, write, develop all kinds of things. So I don't feel a responsibility to write activism songs, for instance. The songs that have enabled me to make enough money to even to be in show business, which is very expensive, are love songs. Up Where We Belong, which won an Academy Award, and Until It's Time For You To Go, which was recorded by Elvis Presley and hundreds of other artists. So it's funny for me. It's kind of a very good question from you, but I don't have a great answer for it. Yeah, it happens pretty naturally for me. I think it's who I am, and I think it's who I was as a little kid, too, because I never played sports. I never played Barbie dolls. I got bullied, and there were sexual predators around, too. So I was the kind of kid who was really happy to go and teach myself how to play the piano, because it was just so much fun. So my activism really comes from a sense of enjoyment and play. And even if it's a tough subject that I'm writing about, I still do it with a sense of, you know, even if it's angry and even if I'm crying when I'm writing the lyrics to some song that deals with, you know, some human event that's just awful, I still feel the same kind of motivation that most people would feel if they were involved in playing, you know, playing a sport that's hard. Or, yeah, so it comes very naturally to me.
I have to say, I've watched so many of your performances, and your emotion comes across so, so beautifully.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't know you'd ever even seen me. I was talking to you like you hadn't.
Also, I just had a question. Has there been a political event or a social experience that has shaped your music in more ways than others?
Oh, gosh. I'm thinking. Nothing's popping up. No, I think that what has shaped me has been the day-to-day, has been the sense of, holy smoke, it's still that way? I mean, most people don't realize that, for instance, in the U.S., most Americans don't realize that that Native people, Indigenous people, we didn't even have religious freedom until the 70s. I mean, you know, just that kind of inequity, unfairness, and the fact that our fellow North Americans aren't even aware of it. See, it's kind of a big picture thing that inspires me. It's no one incident. People like, you know, in the 1960s, there were several writers, you know, really good writers like Phil Oakes and Tom Paxton, and they'd pick up the newspaper every day and they'd say, okay, our writing assignment today is to write a song about something in the newspaper today. And that's wonderful. That's terrific. But it's not what I do. That's not what I'm doing. I'm not looking for show business material. Life's happening to me. And as an artist, I'm lucky enough to have the motivation and the interest, as well as a little bit of skill to turn it into something. But I'm not doing it as career fodder. I mean, it's what I'm doing anyway. And it's strange because I'm in show business just by accident anyway. I was actually trying to go to India and to become a philosophy professor or, you know, to be involved in Oriental philosophy, because that's what my degree came from. I didn't go to McGill, but I went to the University of Massachusetts, which is also good, and I majored in Oriental philosophy, but I couldn't go to India. That became impossible for me. So I had to do something, and that's when I got into show business. So it's kind of a secondary thing for me, and I think it makes it a little bit different, because most artists that you hear or see, most everybody is involved in show business, and I am too, and it's a lot of fun. But that's not my primary goal. It's show business is kind of the vehicle through which I'm trying to do other things as well, like let people know about important issues.
Exactly, that's really, really cool.
I hope.
I was just going to ask you another question about your history. And I know that you were blacklisted from radio in the 60s because of the issues you chose to sing about.
Maybe not. Maybe not. Maybe yes, maybe not. We don't know for sure. We don't know why. We don't know why. It was no one song, you know. People just became suspect of me. Also, you know, the show business is very competitive, and it certainly was then, too. So you had a lot of business sharks and fat cats just trying to shove everybody out of the way and make room for their artists. Because there were only two or three artists that you got to hear about. But there were hundreds of artists who were really, really good at the time, you know, and still are. There always are. But the business side of show business is not about the music. The business side of show business is businessmen pushing their artists and, you know, burying everybody else. So I think it was a combination of just the competitiveness of show business, plus the fact that two political administrations, Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, their guys didn't want me opening my mouth about, you know, environment, and the fact, well, you know, they just did not want Indigenous people, especially, interfering with their complete control of available lands and natural resources. So it's kind of a complicated issue. The reason why I was blacklisted.
I have a question about what you would say to young activists and musicians today.
Oh, well, it depends on what your goals are, you know. If you just want to get your name in the paper once, and a lot of people do, you know, that's okay, then you do something big and inflammatory and it goes away in a month. But if you really do want to change the world, you have to take care of yourself. Don't burn out. Don't burn out. Don't get so involved with some troll on the internet that you discourage yourself. You know, you got to let some things go in one ear and out the other, and just keep on with whatever your mission is. And, you know, your mission changes all the time. But if you're a giving person, or if you're a person who really wants to solve big picture issues, it's not difficult. You just do it one day at a time. And when you have an opportunity to speak up or to offer something or to help, you do it. And next month it might be something else. But if you're a lifelong, positive person, and that is like the heart of your mission, you find ways to be involved. Sometimes in a very small way, and other times in big ways. But life's out there, you know. Life is out there happening. It's not a matter of us sitting around designing it. So, you know, if you want to help, look for opportunities.
Yeah, and I really appreciate watching what you've done. As an artist and a songwriter and activist myself, I really appreciate everything you've done. I'm so in awe of the work you've done, to be quite honest.
Thanks. Are you coming to the Folk Alliance things, too?
Is that a concert?
It's a whole lot of activities going on in Montreal. Let's see, the 13th, 14th, 15th, I think, is the date.
Oh, it's so interesting. I'll check it out.
Yeah, the Folk Alliance. I think it starts on the 13th. Now, I don't know if it's open to the public, so you better find out first. But I'm giving a keynote. I'm giving a keynote to the Indigenous part of the Folk Alliance on the 14th. And I'm going to be talking to Indigenous songwriters and people who are trying to establish a Native music industry. I'm just going to be sharing my experiences with them about both the show and the business, because the show business is about both the show and the business. And I think that we could be, I'm glad that it's starting to happen, but, I think everybody needs a little spotlight and encouragement at how to do it without burning out the first year, because it's very much uphill. Yeah, but it's fun.
You've been singing about the environment and environmental justice since long before it became a mainstream concern. Can you speak to how you have centered indigeneity in environmental justice?
Oh, gosh, you know, if you had been walking in my shoes these past 50-something years that I've been traveling around as a singer, it'd be very obvious that, you know, colonialism is based in European greed and control and lack of understanding. And the lack of understanding about the environment is primary. I mean, Native America, you know, or indigenous people throughout the world are very, very close to nature, but Europe was an anomaly. Europe was, you know, became governed by popes and kings and serial killers and people who were very much into, if we don't control it, then it must be of the devil. And that was very, very real for hundreds and hundreds of years. And I think, you know, that kind of control of women, of money, of nature, colonials, people in Europe thinking that nature was of the devil, it just comes right down from the pecking order, from the popes and the kings who wanted to control everybody. And it's so different in Native America. I mean, I'm a scholar, so I do know about Europe, right? But as a person, it's not secondary material that I had to read about. I've been in these Native communities who go to a clean spot and pray and work together to preserve, to bring back the buffalo, to bring back wilderness areas that have been mistreated by business people. So there's a huge lack of understanding, and there's a huge gulf between Native America and European colonialism when it comes to nature and the environment. the Europeans were taught for generations that you're supposed to defeat it. You're supposed to fight it. You're supposed to get rid of it and control it. And like my song, No No Keshegesh, No No Keshegesh is kind of a funny song in the first place. Keshegesh means greedy guts. So you're saying, No No Keshegesh, No No Greedy Guts. You can't continue to treat nature the way that you do. You can't do that no more. It says Mother Nature, got Mother Nature on a luncheon plate. They carve her up and call it real estate. Want all the resources and all the land. They break the law for it, blow things up for it. So in that way, I am coming from an indigenous point of view and from primary experience in the native communities for years, really, for years. And why not speak from that platform, since that's who I am, what I know, what I do? But it's very tricky as a songwriter, which I'm sure as a songwriter you understand. I mean, how do you actually put that into a format that doesn't sound like a speech? It doesn't sound like some politician yelling at you, you know? So you have to be clever. So you put it in a rock and roll track. You give it a great video. You make it danceable. And once people do hear the words, they say, oh, wow, you know, that makes a lot of sense, but it's also kind of, it has a sense of humor to it, too. And that's part of it, really. That's part of not burning out. You have to take care of yourself. Sometimes what you need is a bed and a bath and time to think. And you don't, you know, since you asked about activism and music and protest, you don't just pedal to the metal all the time. No, you a bed and a bath, and you think about things and you let things calm down, and basically you're turning shit into shinola.
I just have one last question for you.
Mm-hmm.
In the book that has come out by Andrea Warner, Buffy St. Marie, the authorized biography, the creation of the Indigenous Music album at the Junos is mentioned. Can you tell us a bit about how that category came about and the work you did to decolonize the Junos in the 1990s?
Oh, thank you. Well, I heard that Elaine Bomberry and Shingoose Johnny were trying to set up a Music of Aboriginal Canada category for the Junos, and I called Elaine and I said, do you need any help? And she said, oh my goodness, yes. So the three of us went in, and Caris, who are the parent organization of the Junos, they don't establish a new music category because they think you deserve it, poor you. No, you have to come up with the numbers and actually show that there are people making records, you know, recording studios, producers, engineers, musicians, songwriters, etc. So Elaine and Shingoose had done that, and we did get to establish the Music of Aboriginal category, the Music of Aboriginal Canada category. But when I showed up at the Junos to open the Junos, I think it was year before last, I was handed a script which is talking about we're here on Anishinaabe territory, which for millennium, and, you know, I changed it. I called the chiefs, and I changed the wording of the address, the opening, the welcoming. Instead of saying that our people have been here for millennia and talking like a damn lawyer. I mean, I just hate that. Why not just say the Anishinaabe people who have been here for thousands and thousands and thousands of years? I mean, it makes a difference. It makes a difference if people understand you. And lawyer talk is meant to trip you up. And it does. It stops the flow of understanding. And so when we say the unceded territory of the Algonquin people. Unceded, what is that? It's another lawyer word. It trips you up. Unceded, does that mean you don't have a seat to sit down on? Or does it mean you don't have any seeds for your garden? Or does it mean you're a tennis player and you're unceded? I mean, so why not just say the unsurrendered territory of the Anishinaabe people who have been here, who've cared for this land for thousands and thousands of years? And see, I got the opportunity and I took it. I got the opportunity to change it. I spoke to the local people who were involved, and we changed it. And now a lot of people are reading that address without the lawyerese words, but making it sound more like real people talk. Sometimes you get a chance to do that, and you do it.
Nice. That's really cool.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for your time.
Okay, you too. Am I ever going to hear your songs?
I hope so.
Tell me your first name again. How do I spell it? Okay. I'm going to find you.
Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate having the chance to talk to you.
Thank you. Thanks, Yashna. Have a great, great day.
You too.
Aloha, Montreal. Aloha, McGill.
And I wish I was dead. If I live till tomorrow, that'll be a long time. But I wheel and I fall and I rise on codeine. And it's real, and it's real one more time. When I was a young girl, I learned not to care. Oh, whiskey, and from it, I often did swear. My mother and father said whiskey's a curse, but the fate of their baby was a minute times are worse, and it's real, and it's real one more time.
Welcome back to Unfit to Print on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. The time now is 5:39. That was Buffy St. Marie with Codeine, and before that, you heard the McGill Daily's culture editor, Yasna Kedemian, interview Buffy herself. Welcome to our introductory course on labor at McGill campus, Unions and Labor 101. First, we want to thank Olivia Berkowitz for their work. We appreciate you coming in to clarify what labor is on campus and talk with us about what work means at McGill. Before we get into some of the more meaty questions, we'd like to clarify some of the language around labor and class for those listeners who have less access to the terminology used in talking about labor and class. Hi, Olivia.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Can you tell us what labor means in a context that's a little bit broader than just a paid job?
Yeah, so in an economics context, it means like human effort, either physical or mental, that's used to produce goods or services. But in a more broad sense, it can just be thought of as the time you put towards something, whether or not it's your official job.
And can you speak to me a little bit about the student unions that are on McGill campus?
So the Student Society of McGill University, or SMU, is the main student union, and then there's other smaller societies for each faculty, and those are advocating for student interests. But there's also labor unions that advocate for workers, more specifically. So there's several on campus. I work with AMUSE, but there's also unions that represent TAs, research assistants, grad students, profs, and many more.
And can you define care work and devalued labor for us, please?
So care work is paid or unpaid labor that relies on the work of caring or supporting others. And devalued labor is essentially work that isn't recognized sufficiently or at all through formal compensation.
And another definition here, what is upper or middle class privilege?
It's the privilege associated with having sufficient wealth to never really be worried about making ends meet. There's a really wide range of experiences within this group, but basically money is just not a major stress factor in life.
So what is the difference between labor and work?
I think that work is a more narrow definition of paid labor that's scheduled at a traditional job, while labor can encompass a lot of work done in a less formal setting, like activism or involvement with a club.
What are workers' rights on campus?
It depends on which collective agreement, which is like the negotiated contract between management and the union. So there's different ones representing different workers, and it also depends if they're unionized or not. If not, it just reverts to the Quebec labor law. But I encourage like all workers to look into if they are unionized and read a copy of their collective agreement to better understand their rights.
And what is precarious labor?
It's basically jobs that aren't secure long-term. So this can be contract work or casual employees. But without a long-term contract, ensuring that these ensuring employment, these workers won't really have any job security or the privilege to like plan out their financial future.
So now that we've clarified some terminology, our next question would be, in what ways are unpaid workers, such as activists, organizers, or club leaders, unprotected by McGill?
So McGill just doesn't really recognize this type of labor as work, and so it's not protected by labor law. So a lot of these positions might not be official jobs, but there's always like an opportunity cost associated with spending time on these projects. So students will perform unpaid work when they could be getting paid elsewhere.
Can you just explain and clarify what opportunity cost means?
So that's basically your best alternative. So for example, the opportunity cost of getting a degree would be what you could have made while working at a job instead.
How is the labor that is done by students on campus, I'm thinking specifically about women and femme people of color, work that definitely benefits the school, student groups like the Black Student Network, how are these students neglected by the institution, as well as certain privileged groups of students like white students, upper middle class students?
So McGill definitely benefits from all the work that students put in, even when that's not a really clear link. If you think about it, like the student groups on campus are a huge draw for why people come to McGill. So groups like the Black Students Network and SACOMS and DriveSave and so many others are filling gaps that McGill is unable to or is unwilling to. And a lot of this work is unprotected and unpaid. And particularly in these groups that are social justice related, this labor is disproportionately done by women of color. And I think there's not really like any easy answers for how to fix this as a whole. It's like part of a bigger discussion. But for those people involved with student groups, like take a look at how much labor in your group is being done by the women of color around you.
How should students sort of begin to facilitate conversations around this?
I think just being conscious of how labor is distributed and then trying to readjust so that the burden is like less on marginalized people, as it so often has been historically and still is.
So going back to language and terminology, how do certain students, specifically white students, upper middle class students, negatively contribute to class division on campus? I'm thinking specifically language around saying things such as "I'm so broke" or "living that student life," and also asking questions like, "What is the real job you want to do? Where are you going to work after you graduate? What real job are you going to do after this cafe job, etc.?"
Yeah, I think that language is really inappropriate, and it kind of co-opts and appropriates what working class people are actually experiencing. And I think the idea of real jobs implicitly like looks down upon those who work these undesirable jobs, as they're described. And they kind of see this as like a temporary inconvenience before starting a real career. And it's sort of this weird superiority. So I think it's really important to recognize that like all work is valid, and even workers who are performing jobs that don't require a degree still deserve to be paid a living wage.
I want to talk about something that I've heard a lot around campus. I've heard a lot of sort of discourse surrounding familial money and support. For example, like many students assume that parents should and are paying for part or even all of tuition and housing. How does this discourse negatively affect students on McGill campus?
Yeah, I think it's just a really dangerous assumption that this is the standard experience. It can really isolate people who don't have this privilege when it's considered the baseline or it's taken for granted. Receiving support from your family is a really huge privilege, and it takes a lot of stress off the university experience. But treating this like the norm is really isolating to students who don't have, that assistance.
How does the pressure of resume building that McGill often encourages exclude and disadvantage students who do not have the money to work for free?
Yeah, it is quite exclusionary because being able to accept an unpaid internship or any other kind of like unpaid work is a really huge privilege, because there's only so many hours in a day, and being able to spend some of them on extracurriculars on top of school and a job to support yourself is just not an accessible reality for a lot of people. And I think that it continues to like widen a socioeconomic gap when unpaid internships are seen as the key to career success, and they're only accessible to people who are already wealthy enough to do them.
I just wanted to ask you about sort of this current iteration of settler colonialism, because I find that on campus we often assume that the intersection of labor rights and class rights and settler colonialism it's contextualized as a historical issue. And I was wondering, can you speak to how this still affects the labor of marginalized groups on campus today, this being settler colonialism?
Yeah, so I think, again, this is a gap that's being filled by student groups and student activists, particularly Black and Indigenous student activists. And I think this supports any kind of progressive image that McGill may want to capitalize on. And I think there's a really gross irony in that they're using this unpaid labor of Black and Indigenous students to have this reputation. And beyond that, the school itself has like a very white student body, and there's a lot of people of color in support work positions, whether it's activism or otherwise. And it's just something to like look at and question.
So how does the history of activism as undervalued, often unpaid labor, especially activist work done by women of color, get forgotten by this so-called progressive left at McGill that we were talking about earlier?
Yeah, so I think it's really important to recognize that activism is labor, even though it's most of the time unpaid. And I think that even though this type of work is really rewarding, that doesn't mean that it shouldn't also be rewarded monetarily. So again, this brings a lot of value to the McGill community. And oftentimes, like at the forefront and behind the scenes, mainly, there's so many women of color putting in all this time towards these causes, and it's been that way historically too. So a lot of this success has been built on unpaid labor, and I think that's really important to recognize.
How does the devaluation of schoolwork, like coursework, as work, further marginalize those who need a paid wage in order to support themselves?
Yeah, so I think this one comes down to the idea of opportunity costs again, because time is money. Basically, so whatever time you do spend on schoolwork, it could have been spent at a paid job. So there's a trade-off between focusing on school or working to support yourself that like some students have to make the decision between those two. And it can also be argued that like students contribute a lot to the university through their like contributions in class and their research assisting. And it really enriches like the learning at the school. So there's a lot of value in this work, but in reality, it ends up being a significant cost to students, both in time and money spent.
I was just wondering, how does a union productively make their demands to the administration?
So the regulations that are protecting workers are decided through a process of collective bargaining, and that's when representatives of a union meet with representatives of management, in this case McGill, to discuss what each side wants to see. And then through this, they come up with something called a collective agreement, which is a binding set of rules for employees and employers to follow, such as wage rates, benefits, hours of work. And these collective agreements have a set length. And during this time, employees are not allowed to strike because it's like agreed upon that they'll follow these rules. But if something, if a rule is broken by management, then employees can file a grievance through their union, which will typically result in management having to fix their mistakes. So within this time, the most significant way that they can make their demands known is through grievances, but in the time leading up to renegotiation, unions will collect information about what's important to their employees, that they can prioritize those things in the next set of negotiations.
And how can activists on campus, social justice groups, communicate with unions in order to facilitate a dialogue about how class intersects with other axes of oppression?
Yeah, so labor rights are really connected with a lot of other activist movements, and I can speak more specifically to AMUSE's work, and we have like a solidarity committee that's main focus is connecting with other social justice groups on campus. We also have discretionary funding that social justice groups can apply for, and we will give them financial support in whatever project if the board decides on it. We have an event tomorrow, actually, with Social Justice Days. That's a film screening about migrant workers, so the details are on the AMUSE Facebook page. But for activists, I think it's important to just educate yourselves on labor as a part of social justice because it interacts with so much else.
Can you tell us a little bit about the screening, where that's going to be and what the film is about?
Yeah, so it's a film called Migrant Dreams, and it's going to be at the Montreal Art Interculturel. And yeah, it's a documentary about temporary and precarious working conditions that migrant workers in Canada face. So that's tomorrow at 6:30. And there's an event on the AMUSE Facebook page.
And is it a free event or is it a...
Yeah, it's a free event. And it's free, open to the public. And there's childcare available. scent-free spaces. And if you need interpretation or translation, we have all of those available.
Wonderful. I was also wondering if you could speak a little bit about the legacies of student strikes, specifically maybe a Muse strikes, or I know you're a floor fellow, so floor fellow strikes at McGill.
Yes, there's a really rich history of strikes that I probably don't have the time to get into, but in terms of floor fellow strikes specifically, floor fellows unionized in 2016, which means that we're now represented by a Muse and we're paid for our work, which I think is great. And yeah, that was a lengthy process of negotiation with McGill. And
previously, were floor fellows, was it an unpaid position?
Yeah, so it was an unpaid position. And the rationale behind that was that we get a place to live as part of the job. But then we realized that the place to live is necessary to do the job. So it wasn't really adequate compensation. And then beyond that, we also didn't have contracts. So it was a pretty precarious situation, because if something happened and a floor fellow was fired, they would instantly lose their home as well as their work.
So finally, what is the Amuse Labor Library, and what resources do they have for students?
The Amuse Labor Library is a collection of literature and zines about labor rights, and it's a really great resource for starting to learn about labor, specifically in the McGill context too. And it can be accessed by emailing Amuse or on our website. There's all the contact information.
Is it a physical space or is it an e-library?
It's a physical space, I believe, at the Amuse headquarters, but there's also some resources available online.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for coming on, Olivia.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks so much for having me.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Unfit to Print on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. That was Shay Leah with Cherish. The time now is 5:57.
Thanks for tuning in to a wonderful show this week. We want to thank Olivia from Amuse and Buffy St. Marie, whose authorized biography you can pick up in your local bookstore. Playing us out, we have Odie with Midnight.
Ani pisu tu junga amalu ni pisu mina lalu mi yosi si KUT 90.3 FM. Ulu mi tu saksa ulang ayok nali u kalimat lugu Stefan aglu ba puskas mi upani ni pisu mi putu su katelau si manengan unikau si kalang ayok amalu nunavik amalu nunavut si unit cabut pinguat lugu pinguat gigit lugu aduwa mi tampani di sampula kami tu sak saulang kami jadi amaluni jauh ini tu salang kami jadi so tampani itu nak cini pukami. Hi, my name is Annie Pisuti and you're listening to Nipuput on CKUT 90.3 FM. Today's show, Nali talks with Stefan Agluba Puskas about his time as a producer on Nipuput, and we have a recording from Nunavut and Nunavik Sivunichavut performing with each other in Ottawa in December. There will also be Inuit music, so enjoy!
This place was a mess, and it was supposed to be our project room, so I spent a day reorganizing everything, and nothing has changed here.
Yeah. Fewer people in the office now, I think.
Fewer people?
Yeah.
There's always maybe just one or two people in the office. Yeah, that was it. But then usually, no, not many people at all. Yeah.
Hi, Stefan.